You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 94, Experiencing Nature.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minding the Brain. Today we have a couple of guests. Today we're going to be talking about the experience of nature and how experiencing nature affects human psychology. Today we have two guests. We have John Zielinski and Dan Rubenstein. And Dan is an Ottawa-based writer, a paddleboarder, and a staff member at Carleton University, who recently came out with his new book, Waterborne, about his long travel paddleboarding. Very interesting book. We'll put a link to get that book in the show notes. And we also have Dr. John Zielinski, a psychologist at Carleton University, specializing in positive psychology and the psychology of nature. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks for having me. Great. Good to see you both. Thanks for having us, Jim.
Let's start talking about what nature actually is, right? So we're talking about experiencing nature, but I think nature is a very broad category. So John, you want to say a little bit about how scientists describe what nature is?
Yeah. The first question is a hard one. Like, potentially nature is everything. Like, we might talk to a physical scientist and they would say, well, even, you know, our cities are things that humans built and humans are part of nature. It's like a termite mound. But usually, as psychologists, when we're studying it, we do make a distinction. And we often ask people what they think nature is as a way to understand it better. One of the things they do commonly say is nature is stuff that's kind of untouched or unspoiled or not the stuff that humans have built. If you ask them to just start listing the features of it, they say things like, you know, trees, wildlife, ecosystems, water. So the things that kind of come to mind. I should maybe also say that we can study physical nature. So we might take people for a walk along the Rideau River on Carleton's campus, or sometimes we might do a study over the internet and show people, you know, a short video clip, images, maybe even sound recording. So virtual representations of nature. I guess when I start talking about the effects of nature, sometimes I'm actually referring to studies that are arguably not actually nature, but make people think of nature.
Yeah. And I know that as a cognitive scientist, many of the same, like if you see a picture of a bird or a real bird, the bird detector in your brain is the same detector occurring in both places. And it's pretty common to, in psychology, to not even distinguish pictures from the real thing. So psychologists will say, we showed them birds. Like, no, you didn't. You showed them GIFs, but
right, yeah.
But yeah, so
sometimes the environmentalists, this is important to them though, because they say, well, if you're telling us that, you know, all the nice things that come from nature comes from images of nature, I guess we could, you know, bulldoze the parks. And I mean, nobody's seriously suggesting that, but some people are sensitive about that implication.
Well, after it's well documented, of course. yeah. Okay. And so my impression is that these studies of nature are mostly about its effects on well-being, but is it more than that? Is they look at intelligence, or do they look at any other? What kind of effects do scientists generally look at?
Yeah, well-being is a big one, and I guess it looms large in my mind too, because I sometimes tell people I study happiness, or I teach positive psychology. So for me, that's a really big one. But the benefits do seem to extend pretty broadly. So when it comes to cognition, nature seems to be really helpful in restoring people's cognitive ability. So if you concentrate on something, you focus your attention, you get fatigued. We've all experienced that. And if you compare a brief break in a natural setting compared to an urban setting, or here again, even like images or videos, nature seems to restore people. It's also good for stress, which is maybe a flip side of well-being. There are indications that it might improve creativity. That often comes along with good moods, but maybe even beyond that, you know, freeing up the mind. It's associated with better physical health. It's associated with better social relationships, less aggression, more pro-social behavior. So, I mean, it doesn't freshen your breath, but there's a pretty long list of things that nature seems to be good for people.
That's a really comprehensive list. I was going to jump in a few times, but John ticked off all of the areas I was going to mention. But another one is ecological health. I mean, spending yes. time in a natural environment tends to enhance pro-environmental behavior, especially among children. And, you know, we think about climate crises and the anxieties and worries that come from that. One way to mitigate that is to be active and play have a positive impact in cleaning up the environment. And we can do that. But if you take your kid outside and they get involved, that kind of encourages the next generation to do so as well. So it extends beyond human health to more than human health, too, I think.
Yeah. So, Dan, do you find that... your experience in nature increases your well-being. Tell me about your personal experience with that.
Yeah, I mean, my kind of entry into this area as a writer, as a journalist, as somebody who really enjoys spending time outdoors, my initial work was more around walking and more recently around paddling. And it kind of stems from a desire to find out why I feel better after I spend time in an outdoor environment. You know, I know that going for a walk or going for a paddle, I come back feeling restored. I come back feeling refreshed. I come back with creative ideas. I wanted to know why. So in my journalism, in two books and a bunch of magazine stories, I was able to talk to researchers who really drill down into some of the things that are happening, you know, cognitively that lead to these outcomes. And, you know, it's not always the case. And researchers, you know, always emphasize when I'm talking to them that the quality of a green space or a blue space can impact its benefits to people, but access to green and blue spaces is not equal, but to both the pros and the cons of natural environment. So, you know, as an affluent white male who has the bikes and the paddle boards and all the tools and toys, I can get out and enjoy nature in and around where I live quite easily, but not everybody has the same exposure. So I certainly feel the benefits. I think one of the things that research can help unlock is that more equitable access can bring about more health equity. So when we think about mm-hmm. the social determinants of health and, you know, socioeconomic variance being a key indicator to whether somebody is healthy or happy or not, well, you know, nobody's going to vote to redistribute wealth and kind of upset the status quo. But if you can improve natural environments, especially in urban areas that have large marginalized communities, if you can develop programs that get people out and active, you're going to see benefits just kind of spike, right? So in terms of bang for your bucks in public investment, there's a strong case to be made for not only improving these spaces, but in enhancing access to these spaces for everybody.
Yeah, that raises a question of dosage, I guess. You know, John and I live near Dundonald Park, which is a small park. It's one city block, right? So it's nature, but it's, you know, it's a postage stamp sized nature. But I've also heard, and John, maybe you can tell me if this is true or not, that even being able to see a tree out your window of a hospital room can have effects on your recovery. Have psychologists looked at the amount of dosage in any sense of time of how much nature is an effective amount?
Yeah, I mean, the dose needed for some positive effect seems to be pretty small and pretty low. And so given all the different kinds of nature and all the, you know, nice things that it seems to do for people, not every single one of those combinations have been studied. But as you mentioned, yeah, there's this classic study that people recover more quickly and take less pain medication. They have a view of a tree. That's a study that's been replicated. It's an old classic that we always refer to, but it works again. So it increases our confidence in it. There's a psychologist. So this is based on correlational data, not like all the experiments we would want, but tried to put together, kind of look at the equations at some of the benefits that come from spending time in nature and well-being, and tried to kind of find the sweet spot where if we were doing something similar to like physical activity guidelines, like you should get, I don't know, is it 2 hours a week of moderate physical activity, they say, it turns out to be similar for nature. And it doesn't mean that, you know, more isn't better, but you do kind of get to a nice spot. It looks like around 2 hours a week in terms of nature. If you're on that lower end too, it might also help to think about how you're engaging with the nature. If you're paying a lot of attention, if you're engaging with it mindfully, as opposed to sitting in your small park, going through your social media feed, perhaps you're not fully taking it in.
Yeah, right. It's about the experience. You have to actually experience the nature, not just be in it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure on your long paddleboard journey, Dan, you encountered bad weather and stuff. What are the effects of like negative nature, like earthquakes and angry animals and rotting carcasses and that kind of thing? That's part of nature too, but doesn't seem to make everyone happy.
Yeah, I mean, headwinds and crosswinds when you're on a paddleboard are not fun. Your body's essentially a sail, and the wind is telling you to go not necessarily where you want to go. But a couple things in that. One, it's a very visceral reminder that you're not in control, that nature is much bigger and more powerful than you. And that's humbling, but also liberating in a sense, right? Because it shows you that, you one tiny speck in the great expanse of time and everything, right? So that kind of takes the pressure off you to be this person accomplishing these amazing things. You're just trying to get where you're going, hopefully without nature stalking you. And there's also the idea of, I think, resilience and hard work. I mean, the subtitle of my book is Pilgrimage. And in my mind, pilgrimage is constant progress towards a distant goal, whatever the progress is, whatever the goal is. And, we have short attention spans. We want, quick fulfillment of our desires these days. But if you're fighting bad weather on a paddleboard or a bike or on foot and it's slowing you down, you have to kind of be determined and realize that it's just one step at a time, one paddle stroke at a time that's going to get you there. So, as a writer, I tend to think metaphorically, and I was on a physical journey, but I was also on a bit of a metaphorical journey. And any change, any progress, any significant advancement or discovery takes this kind of constant progress, constant work. And so, on one hand, bad weather slows me down, then it's more effort and I'm going to get wet or cold or more tired than it would be otherwise. But on the other hand, it's a reminder that you have to put in the time, you have to put in the work to get anywhere meaningful. And that's an important lesson that I took away from that trip and many of my outdoor travels.
John, did you want to say anything about the sort of the valence of natural stimuli?
Yeah, no, it's good to bring this up. So from, when I'm talking about studies, I showed people nature and they got in a good mood. I'm usually not talking about, stinky swamps or decaying, carcasses or things like this. So it is important to acknowledge that there are unpleasant or even, life-threatening parts of nature. And when we talk about the benefits of nature for well-being, we usually are talking about those pleasant parts. With that said, humans seem to be attuned to nature in a way that some of those unpleasant things we can think of as part of this human and nature connection. Like we have evolved to, keep a little more distance of things like snakes and spiders. Like it's easy to learn those things. And in a way it kind of speaks to how humans, we evolved in nature and we have these connections to nature. So in a way that open fresh water and landscapes with abundant resources are pleasant to us or appealing to us, and we would seek them out. We can kind of think of it as our minds responding to some of the persistent natural threats, but with a different kind of reaction, one that was good for our ancestors.
So have people actually studied the negative natural things, or is it just sort of people just stick to the positive stuff?
There have been studies of, for example, it seems to be easier to learn a fear or learn a phobia for things like snakes and spiders. There's research that suggests that much of the research is positive. And actually, it's also the positive stuff is so much more frequent. If you ask people about what comes to mind for them when you ask about nature, very few people bring up the negative things. And as a researcher, I mean, kind of when I think about the benefits of nature, that this anecdotal evidence is almost as persuasive to me as some of the things I can back up with statistics. But sometimes we might try to to find images of nature, some kind of virtual representation of nature, and say, okay, but I want to match it to a built environment that's equally pleasant. And so you get some like very mundane nature, like a boring suburban yard, and people are still rating that higher than some pretty beautiful and impressive architecture. And it's just kind of mind-boggling how hard it is to find nature. It's possible, don't get me wrong, but it's a lot harder than you would think to find nature that is mundane to negative, unless you're really trying to.
I guess I'm interested in like controlling for it though. Like if you have, let's just say you have a set of stimuli and they're all equally beautiful or something. Are there different, is there an effect of it being nature on well-being, for example? Like independent of the beauty.
Yeah, there are few studies to have a conclusive answer. There is one series that suggests possibly not, but it's one of these in part where it was so hard to match the stimuli. It was so hard to find kind of built environments that matched. There were these categories, like they didn't have anything to compare the best nature to. They couldn't find it. There are some other studies that kind of abstract some of the low-level visual features of natural scenes. So like the amount of disorder, the amount of curved lines or straight lines, and tried to abstract these and see like, do you get some of the same cognitive or pleasantness ratings for just these contours, these low-level visual features. And sometimes that does work out. So you can kind of get nature effects, even if they're not consciously construed as nature. On the other hand, you can place somebody, white noise or pink noise, and tell them that it's either a factory or tell them that it's a waterfall. And then you do see a diversion. So it seems like kind of this works in both ways. Understanding that something is nature might help us enjoy it. On the other hand, even being unaware of it, it might still kind of have those kinds of effects.
That's very interesting because I sometimes as a, I didn't know about that, about the white noise and how you interpret it, but I live sort of in downtown Ottawa, and when I hear sirens when I'm trying to sleep, sometimes I imagine that it's a dragon flying by, making sound, and I transform things in my head to things that I... when the convoy was here, I imagined it was a Venga bus. That's a 90s reference. Did you have something to say, Dan?
Yeah, I've heard a mountain lake described as the ultimate happy place by an environmental psychologist, Matt White, who's at the University of Vienna. And I think this is based on a Dutch study using this Mappiness app, in which thousands of respondents kind of chimed in with their level of happiness, well, with GPS kind of coordinates. So they were able to say that in these spots, people were this happy, and in those spots, people were that happy. So kind of ranking spaces, and a mountain lake had the right combination visually and other set of physical characteristics where people scored at the top.
And I was thinking like beautiful art, but then I thought, well, a lot of the art people find beautiful is depicting nature. it's not all... Samantha Fox photos. Dan, are you ever surprised more people don't spend more time outside? Like, do you feel like they would like it if they did?
Yeah, I think there's a perception about the outdoors that it is dangerous, that it is unpleasant, that, we're so sheltered and cocooned in our homes. We're used to, our interactions are mediated by screens. We hop in the cars. We're in air-conditioned spaces in the summer and heated spaces in the winter. Our lives are getting smaller in a sense, right? And that cliched adage, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing, right? If you have gear, which is a socioeconomic issue, if you have gear, you can be outside. And then you discover in kind of small forays and small steps just how uplifting it can be, how restorative it can be. And it's an iterative thing. You don't go for a 17-hour hike if you've never hiked before. You go for a short walk and you kind of take these baby steps and you discover the restoration, you feel the benefits, and then you do it again, maybe a little longer, a little further, a little more challenging. So, I'm personally surprised. I know there are systemic barriers that limit exposure to the outdoors. I think there's more collectively that can be done to facilitate access. Again, it's kind of the horse I'm riding in this one here. Yeah, it's funny. I did a story with the Carleton water researcher Banu Ormici recently about swimming in the Rideau River, and a lot of people will not swim in the river because they think it's dirty. It hasn't been dirty for decades. She's literally testing the water, showing that it's clean, and people still will not go in the water, even though you have a wastewater researcher with the data saying it's good, go in there. So we're afraid of these things because of, you know, it's the same idea that people are more afraid of flying than driving, even though you're much more likely to be hurt in a car accident than a plane crash. We think the river's dirty, so we're not going to hop into it. Whereas it's right there and we can take advantage of it. We just don't.
John, what does the research say about people's estimation of the effects of nature?
Yeah, it resonates very much with what Dan's saying. And I totally agree that there are these kind of like faraway parts of nature, these unknown natural spaces that that might generate extra fear. But we found even for things that people are pretty familiar with, that they seem to underestimate the mood benefits or mood boosts they might get from nature. So we've done this now with even like short video clips. So we can boost a person's mood like pretty substantially. I mean, just their mood. We're not making them happy people forever, but with a 2-minute nature video. And if we ask them beforehand, you know, how good they think they'll feel afterwards, they tend to underestimate how good it's going to make them feel. We've done the same thing on and around Carleton's campus, taking students on short walks along the river, the canal. And so these are places that are very close to where they spend a lot of time. So we think they're pretty familiar with them. And we tell them where we're going to go. But then after we take the walk, they feel better than they predicted ahead of time. So people seem to, at least in the instances that we've tried, seem to underestimate. They don't say it's going to be horrible, but they underestimate how much better it makes them feel. And we've speculated, these why questions are hard to answer definitively, but that the reasons might be very similar to what Dan is saying too, that there's kind of this general disconnection from nature that is a feature of modernity. And this has been supported in other ways too. You know, if you like look at natural imagery or nature in books and music and in culture, that seems to have been decreasing the study I'm thinking of right now in the U.S. I think most of the examples I can think of are in the English language, but I suspect it's probably not limited to that.
Yeah, you know, is there a difference between? You know, I'm sure that people study well-being in a couple of ways, but is there ever a difference between the moment-to-moment happiness and the retrospective attribution of happiness? And if there is, might that explain maybe why people forget how happy they are in nature or something?
Well, you're giving me good ideas. I don't know of studies about nature specifically, but the studies I can think of oftentimes go in the other way, where but kind of with positive or negative, not so much. But if you, for example, do what we call an experience sampling study, so I ask you, how are you feeling right now? And I do that multiple, you know, many times, and then try to estimate kind of your in the moment happiness accurately as you were just experiencing it, that tends to be more mundane. So you get kind of lower levels of both pleasant and unpleasant emotions than if you ask people to retrospect it later. So it's almost like our memories and our predictions for these discrete experiences are often more intense than they turn out to be. Like people kind of forget the boring and mundane parts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about feelings of connection to nature. Is that something that predicts nature's effects, or does nature cause people to feel more connected, and what are its effects on well-being?
Yeah, so this is kind of how I got into research in this area. A student just turned up in my office, now a dear friend as well, and said, "You're the happiness guy. I think, you know, nature will make people happy. And then if it did, maybe they would treat it better too." So kind of that whole picture. And where we began was this subjective sense of connection with nature. Oftentimes it's studied as a feature of personality, or a sense of self, a sense of identity, this sense that I am very much a part of nature. I'm closely connected to nature compared with other people who don't have this, who score low on a measure of this, who say that like, no, I'm very separate. Like nature is apart from me. Maybe they don't like it. And in broad strokes, what we found is, yeah, having this strong sense of connection with nature is associated with a lot of the same positive things that physical nature contact is. It's a little tricky to pull those apart, because people who do feel connected to nature are also the same people that like to go out and experience it. but as a sense of self and a personality feature, it's kind of something you can take with you and have as a sense of self or a way of understanding the world, even when you're not in nature. If we just, you know, take people into nature, that does seem to increase it in the moment too. So it can both vary over time in a person, being higher when you're with nature, but also a relatively stable individual with friends.
Yeah, Dan, I assume you feel fairly close to nature, but do you feel maybe when you're on these grand trips that it's enhanced and does it last? Or do you think that your feeling is sort of constant and it's just sort of a part of who you are?
No, I think it does linger. It does stay with you. I mean, it, depending on the intensity of the experience, it can linger longer and you can remain higher longer, definitely. But just picking up on something John said earlier about the capacity of nature to enhance or encourage social interaction. That's one of the things about blue space. Not to compare blue space and green space because they're interrelated and you need the water to have the green, right? But I think when you're around water in particular, it has these restorative qualities as other natural environments do. It tends to slow us down. You know, some boats go quickly, but most people, when they're in, on, or around water, the pace is moderated by the environment. And there's an element of danger about a natural environment that has water to it. Drowning is dangerous, flooding, storms, etc. And I think it's that combination of factors, the enhanced well-being, the slower pace, and the kind of watching out for one another, which encourages interaction between people. And if you think about loneliness and isolation and the negative impacts of those on mental health, anything that kind of, and even if it's just mundane, you know, making small talk with a stranger about the weather or a smile exchange with somebody, any kind of social interaction you have in an environment makes you feel better too. So it's not only internally feeling better, it's connecting with other people or in that space leaves me with a feeling of well-being. So when I come off the water, when I come off the hike, you know, I'm not always just kind of thinking about the birds I saw or the flowers I saw. It might be an interaction with somebody, however fleeting, that lingers with me and kind of gives me a lift for the rest of the day.
Yeah. I wonder, I have a question, maybe observation/question for Dan, that when we talk about this sense of connection with nature, I oftentimes do use the metaphor of a social relationship. So, you know, like you can have a close or more distant relationship with a family member. You can have this with nature. And I'm never sure how far to push it, but I've been listening to each of your audiobook. So it's interesting to hear a different voice now connected with these ideas. you mentioned, you know, I said hello to the fox or the squirrel. I'm trying to remember, like, kind of talking to nature. So am I going too far if I'm like, no, it's like a social relationship. You can have a connection, you can communicate, you can feel like you have a friendship with nature, only the elements in nature.
Definitely. And my thinking is kind of still evolving in that area. I recently read a book called Theory of Water by an Anishinaabe writer and scholar, Leanne Betasamisake Simpson. And she writes about, I mean, the interconnectedness of human and more than human life. And I mean, the book is about water and the fact that when you breathe out, the water particles in your breath are breathed in by the person beside you, and water literally links us. But all plants and animals and human beings have this connection, right? We all are the same. We all are water in a sense, right? So I think, you know, not to get too far down that road, and it's a theory I'm still kind of digesting and thinking about, I do feel this connection. And when I'm out there for hours on a paddleboard by myself, I mean, you start off with this kind of metronomic paddle stroke action. It's a very meditative activity. And suddenly you're not really physically present thinking about where you are or what you're doing. You're just in this natural environment. You're absorbing it subconsciously. There's, you know, soft fascination kicks in and you are talking to and communing to all of these things, you know, even if it's not a purposeful, intentional activity, you know, those are who you're with, right? Another book I read recently is called Is a River Alive by a British nature writer, Robert McFarlane. And it's kind of about the rights of nature movement, but he's literally asking the question, is a river alive? And comes away concluding, yes. I mean, it is, you know, by many definitions, this flowing water is an entity that, you know, that has a voice that, you know, that we can listen to and talk to.
Have you read the book The Rights of Nature by Dan Boyd?
I have not, but I'm writing down the name right now.
Yeah, it's by a lawyer or a legal scholar, and who talks about how different countries are giving rights to natural things like rivers and forests, because it's the law is based on protecting and giving rights to people who might enjoy the nature, but some places, and we're quite behind in our part of the world on this, but there are some places that are really like trying to protect things as having natural things as having rights.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this kind of the legal personhood status, the argument is that if a corporation can be given standing in a courtroom, then why not a river or a forest or a mountain? Don't they have rights, the right to subsist and persist, and that those rights be respected? But it's also about kind of knocking humans off the top of, an artificial hierarchy. You know, we've placed ourselves at the top of this pedestal or pyramid. It's causing a lot of ecological and social problems if we see ourselves as part of, you know, a more level playing field where, you know, I'm no better than that squirrel or that tree, and I need to value their lives as much as my own life in order for all of us to live, then maybe we make different decisions. And you know, this is a long a long-term transformation, and you know, my fingers are crossed that that campaigns such as the Rights of Nature movement will succeed, and it will reorient our thinking. I think, you know, one way or another, we're going to have to change the way we look at, you know, a river, and is it a resource to be exploited, or is it an entity that, you know, if it's gone, we're gone too, right? So I think it's a really important conversation, and it's encouraging see books like the two I just mentioned to see them coming out in pretty short succession and getting a decent amount of attention, coming from different perspectives, you know, coming from Cambridge and coming from Northern Ontario, right?
Yeah. Earlier on, Dan was talking about the effects of experience in nature affecting people's environmental sympathies and that kind of thing. John, do you want to say a little bit about the science behind that stuff?
Yeah, that's one of the strongest links. So particularly for people who develop this sense of connection with nature, this subjective sense. And it does seem to be something that's really accessible to most people. So at the very beginning, I said, you know, most people define nature as things that are separate from humans. But if you just ask them a simple question, like, are you part of nature or separate from nature, the majority of people, like even North American, you know, contemporary humans will tell you, yeah, I am also part of nature, even if we define it. So, but like both of those ideas exist in our head. But yeah, when people spend time in nature, particularly when they develop this strong sense of subjective connection, it's very strongly associated with wanting to protect nature, with doing nice things for the environment. So I often tell people that what we've been working on and trying to put all these things together in the research is this happy path to sustainability that goes through nature, that maybe I can entice some people to spend a little bit more time in nature because it will improve their well-being or their cognitive fatigue or some of these things that they already know they value, with kind of the idea that once they start doing that, they might also want to treat nature better and engage in more sustainable behavior, and that ends up being good for humans and, you know, the rest of nature too.
Yeah. I did a little research back in grad school about zoos, and one of the arguments for a zoo is that it engenders sympathy for wildlife and the protection of it. So I think that's really great. Thank you, everyone. I would encourage anyone interested in these issues or paddleboarding to check out Waterborne. That Dan wrote, and there's a link to that in the show notes. And John Zelensky wrote a book on positive psychology that you can also get. I don't have that to hold up because I am friends with John and read a preprint PDF. John, introduce the book. Hold it up and just tell people where to get it.
Let me tell you, you should get Dan's book. This is not the same kind of page turner. This is a textbook that designed for university students, but I don't know. My mom's friend said she liked it, but I think she was just being nice.
I think we have a lot of serious people who read serious stuff listening to my podcast. If I do say so myself.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you so much, John and Dan. And I hope everyone, if you didn't listen to this walking around in nature on your own, please get outside and enjoy the fall.
Good advice. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, John. Look forward to seeing you both on campus.
Likewise. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science and Rainwater, covering the Earth in fresh water for over 4 billion years. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. You can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Minding the Brain, and you can find us on YouTube at Minding the Brain Podcast. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain. Thank you.